listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
Obviously, the most immediately important thing to discuss is the decision by the Second Instance Appeal Court in Brazil to confirm the original deeply flawed conviction of the now presidential candidate, the former president of Brazil, Inácio Lula da Silva. And they actually increased the sentence from 9 years to 12. But before we start looking at that, and I think it's important to put that, what's happening in Brazil and also in Ecuador and also in Argentina, in context. Because what's happening, all these events are part of much larger processes that are going on in Latin America that continually take us back to the fundamental dynamic that is driving political events in Latin America. What's that dynamic? We talked about it so many times, Don. And it fundamentally, the impoverished majority in Latin America now know that they can have access to a better life. And they can achieve that through electoral politics. And as was demonstrated in the first 10-12 years of the current century. Now, at the same time, against that, the wealthy oligarchic elites in the region are fiercely pushing back because they've seen that progressive governments do actually make a big difference, and so they to their ability to manipulate events, and as you said, to collaborate in the foreign looting and pillage of their country's economies. Right. So that is the fundamental dynamic. The impoverished majority want a better life, and they also want they've also experienced what it means to have meaningful participation in the political right. decisions that affect them.
Right.
So you've got the right wing pushing back against that. So how are they going to push back against that? And in all these countries, in Colombia, Mexico, Brazil, Chile, Peru, Ecuador, well, in all these countries, the right wing traditionally have control over just about all the available institutional resources. So when a government, especially the judiciary, for example, or for example, the corporate media stranglehold
right.
on information that arrives to the people in those countries. And then if you look at the cultural inheritance is one dominated by the colonial heritage, which is obviously very much in favor of the right. status quo and the regional elites.
Yep.
And then if you look at the commercial and economic areas, of course, the oligarchies, they've had a couple of centuries to entrench their economic and control and their control of trade. So what's astonishing about the first 10, 12 years of this century is the extent to which progressive governments like those of Comandante Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Evo Morales in Bolivia, Rafael Correa in Ecuador, Daniel Ortega here in Nicaragua, and the Kirchners in Argentina, Ignacio Lula da Silva in Brazil, they radically transformed the situation of the huge impoverished majorities in their countries. And so what we're seeing now is the regional right wing reacting against that. How are they reacting against it? Well, one of the ways that they're reacting against it is that they're becoming increasingly dependent on United States diplomatic aggression, but in a world context where United States power and influence and status and control is declining against its
yep.
global rivals.
Right.
So that means that the regional elites, on the one hand, they're playing a double game. On the one hand, they're collaborating with aggressive U.S. diplomatic measures, aggressive U.S. military measures, increasing U.S. military presence in the region. But on the other hand, they're also cutting very important deals in terms of their own national economies with the big economies of Asia, in particular China, of course, but not just China, also South Korea, Thailand, the Philippines, Taiwan, the countries of the ASEAN countries, and to a lesser extent India. So all those processes are in play. And what we're seeing at the moment is, you see, what is the alternative for the Latin American right if they don't somehow manage to neutralize or destroy the threat of progressive politics that would undermine their position? They've experienced a decade of relative impotence, and they don't like it. So they are now using all the levers of power that they have at their disposal in the current and in particular the politicization of the judiciary in order to get what they want. So now having said that, and I think that sets the scene for understanding what's going on in Brazil.
Right. I agree. So, and not only that, just to confirm that this isn't just a, singly personal held illusion, I'm looking at a piece. Jose Mujica, the former president of Uruguay, says exactly the same thing, that he doesn't believe in the objectivity of Brazil's justice system generally and in particular with respect to this case. And, of course, you can see exactly what happened last time when you had an attack, successful attack on Dilma Rousseff, the former president, the last elected president of Brazil, where she was removed by a group of people who themselves, it turned out, are actually crooks, and so crooked that even the right-wing media and the judiciary there couldn't protect them from the fact patterns that have become known of crookedness.
Yeah. Yeah, for example, the person that Eduardo da Cunha, the person that drove the illegitimate process that remove Dilma Rousseff from government. I mean, the public prosecutor is now asking for that he served 300 years in jail.
300 years.
So, what that complicates analysis of what's going on, because if you look at the kind of centre-right media and the neo-colonial media in the NATO countries, for example, The Guardian or The New York Times or The Washington Post, they will then say, oh, well, this person's been convicted by the justice system. So therefore, they must be guilty, you know. And so it's like, it's a bit like it's straight out of Kafka, isn't it? If you look at this trial of Lula da Silva, it's the first of I think it's five or six cases that have been brought against him, all on the basis of testimony by people collaborating with the authorities in order to get a reduction of their sentence.
All by crooks, in other words.
Yeah, all by crooks. But in Ireland and Britain, there's a word called supergrass. So it's somebody who testifies against their former colleagues and gets either complete immunity or a substantive reduction. In the sentence that they might otherwise receive. So,
and especially you're in a position here where, you know, the object is one of, you know, deep-rooted institutional and interest-based hostility and opposition.
Yeah, sure. The whole motif of corruption, as you've pointed out so in many of our conversations, is one that's wide open to abuse and exploitation by the most powerful interests in the region, in particular, of course, the government of the United States. And it's the government of the United States and its representatives that have worked closely with the regional elites in order to mount these politicized judicial attacks. In particular, through the use of the notorious Odebrecht scandal. Let's look at this particular case in which Lula da Silva has been sentenced to 12 years for corruption. It involves the allegation that he received a luxury condominium in exchange for giving preference in the assignation of public contracts to a company called OAS, which I think is a construction company that works in the petrochemical sector, among others. Now, at the same time that those judges yesterday were saying that they believed that although there was no concrete proof, they believed that this was likely to be true, because that's now the current legal doctrine almost across the region.
Likely to be true? Really?
Yeah, it could be true. It could, with some degree of probability. They call it indicios. Indications that it may be true.
Right.
And that is now sufficient proof to send somebody like Lula da Silva to jail for 12 years. But if you an actual legal fact that occurred in the couple of weeks prior to the events yesterday was that the same public prosecutor that has made that accusation against, or the same office of the public prosecutor, not an individual, that made that accusation against Lula, accepted in a case against OAS that they were the legal owners of the condominium of which Lulu is supposed to have received as a bribe.
So, listen, a bribe is a payment or some other transfer of beneficial rights to property or some other thing of value, okay? And there is always physical evidence of this. Either there's a bank account that you can trace back, you know, the deposits, or there's a piece of real estate with title documents, or there's a thing, a block of gold or something, and you can say, where did you get that, and trace its, you know, custody back. So what's been produced in terms of evidence, you know, along those lines? Nothing.
Zero, nothing. Lula da Silva visited the condominium once. He'd never stayed there overnight. And it's now been demonstrated that he's not the legal owner, that OAS is the legal owner.
So there's
actually no all the actual proof disproves the allegation by the public prosecutor.
I'm sensitive to this issue, okay? I'm an expert in this, not in Brazilian law, but in American law, and specifically, particularly, New York law. I've got 45 years in the title insurance business. Deeds, title documents, these are things that, you know, I testify as an expert in court on for decades. And so there's no deed with Lula's name or a corporation's name that he owns or some trust or something, nothing. So, and nobody's produced like a long-term lease that's not recorded or something that shows.
Well, nothing, zero.
Well, then it's not his.
Right.
A bribe requires a transfer of ownership and or custody of something, and if he doesn't have possession and he doesn't have the title documents, then it ain't his.
Right, so this brings us back to something that we've commented on in the past. It doesn't matter if there's no evidence.
Right.
The process is what matters.
Right.
Straight out of Kafka, the trial. Wow. The process is what matters. Mm. So, and that's also true in the case of Jorge Glass, who is the former Ecuadorian vice president, who was sentenced to, I think it's 6 years in jail, which is currently a sentence he's currently serving, also on the basis of testimony from individuals who received the benefit as a result of their corrupt testimony. And zero physical proof, physical evidence in that case against Jorge Glass. Now, so, but the curious thing about this case is that everybody in Brazil, even the judges in the case acknowledged that there was no evidence against Lula. But what they've established as the current legal principle in these kinds of cases is that if there is sufficient suspicion indicating that, in their opinion, Lula da Silva might probably have been guilty of even though there's no evidence, then that's good enough.
Wow. I mean, this reminds me of Obama saying, oh, due process? Yeah, we do process. We do a process. When he's talking about droning people.
Right. Oh, no. But this comes straight out of the United States and its NATO allies culture. And as an Irish citizen, I have a very strong memory of the case of the Birmingham Six. Who were sentenced to 30 years in jail for a terrorist attack they never did, and the most distinguished jurist in British modern British legal history, a character called Lord Denning, said that they must be guilty because if they were not guilty, that would open up the appalling vista, was the phrase that he used. And so his judgment became known as the appalling vista's judgment, the appalling vista that the police and the legal authorities would have told lies.
Wow.
And that's why although all the evidence was in their favor, that's why he made sure that they stayed in jail until their ultimate exoneration, of course. So that this idea that suspicion is enough is not a Brazilian innovation. It has a long and distinguished history in Western jurisprudence.
Oh, please. Let's go to Salem, Massachusetts, okay? Let's hold her underwater. If she drowns, she wasn't a witch.
All right, but you don't even have to go back that far. And you go back to the 50s. You know very well the history of the African American, of black activists, of people like Leonard Peltier, of people like Lee Stewart.
Oh, for sure.
So there's nothing in the Western legal history that gives them any cause for any kind of moral superiority when they look at this kind of process in Brazil. And then, so if you step back from Brazil and look at the broader region, we've already mentioned the case against Jorge Glass. But also, if you look at what's going on in Brazil, in Argentina, the cases that are being brought against former President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her former ministerial colleagues are all based on very similar kind of manipulation and abuse of legal principles.
And even of logic, like of factual logic.
Yeah. And sticking with the focus on what are the legal mechanisms that are abused. For example, let's take the case of Milagro Sala, and she's a deputy in the regional Pala Sur. It's the regional parliament for the Southern Cone. And she's been in prison for over 2 years now under the legal figure of preventive detention. She's not been sentenced at all. She's being held in preventive detention for an accusation that has never been proved and never been sentenced.
To prevent what? To prevent her from leaving the jurisdiction or something? What's being prevented?
Well, the argument is that if she were not kept in jail, she might influence the outcome of the trial.
That's what she's supposed to do, I thought. That's what a trial is. You're supposed to challenge the allegations, and that's how you influence them.
No, and it's a measure that was originally brought in under the Argentinian military dictatorship. Mm. And the other legal figure that's being abused. And the reason I know anything at all about this is because I read an article by a former attorney general. I think his name is Zaffaroni. Sympathetic to the
defense
policy or the political position of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her colleagues. So the other legal figure that he mentioned in his article is the accusation of illicit association. So if some people were found to have been, and I suppose the equivalent in U.S. law would be some version of conspiracy, but here in Argentina it's specifically being used in the case of the AMIA terrorist attack, to argue that Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her colleagues conspired or got together and argued that they should influence in an illicit way the investigation by Interpol into the AMIA terrorist attack. But Ronald Noble, who was the head of Interpol at the time, has specifically and very deliberately spoken out in favor of Cristina, saying that, much to my surprise, because I always assumed that he was just some kind of mindless functionary who would do whatever his political superiors told him to. But in his favor, Ronald Noble spoke out, and he said that the accusation against Cristina is absurd, because she never tried to influence Interpol's policy on the AMIA case. So despite that, the accusation continues. And as we said just now, it doesn't matter if there's no evidence. It doesn't even matter if there's evidence in disproving the accusation, like Ronald Noble's testimony. That doesn't matter.
Right.
What matters is the process. Why is it this emphasis on the process? Because the motivation is not legal, it's political.
That's the same as here in the United States, actually. They have executed people notoriously here, despite evidence of the innocence, because it was submitted too late, and some statute, you know, or procedural, calendar item had been passed by. And so the courts themselves would say, as this person was on their way to being executed and ultimately executed, look, you know, yeah, this is exculpatory, but you didn't file it in time, too late.
Yeah. So, and so, for the benefit of our listeners, what is the political motivation? I mean, to actually spell it out.
Right.
And the political motivation is to destroy the possibility of a united progressive political movement capable of challenging the control of the regional elites in their respective countries.
Right. That's it.
And so, in Argentina, the big challenge for the various radical and progressive political movements and political parties in Argentina is to unify.
Yep.
Will they be, if because the right wing have learned the lesson of the previous 15 years, that or every time they went into elections divided, and they lost to a progressive candidate.
Right.
So now the left in Argentina, places like Argentina, in Brazil, in Ecuador, the left and progressive parties, radical progressive parties, have to relearn that lesson.
Yeah.
They have to unite.
Yep.
And if they don't, the right wing are going to stay in power for a long time.
Yep.
If they do unite, the right wing are finished.
Well,
and it really is that simple.
And what tends to happen is, even if the political geniuses on the left don't get that lesson quick, ultimately the people relearn that lesson and they leave the leadership, quote-unquote, behind, because the things are so compelling. You're talking about the fundamentals of survival, you know, housing, education, food security, medical assistance, all of that. And when people are lacking that for a sufficient period of time, particularly people who have been shown that it's only a couple of steps away from them, if only they do this or that thing, sooner or later, it just happens. It's repeatedly happened over the entire history of our species. It must be something that's innate.
Right. And so the right wing, I mean, the fundamental fear of the right wing is that they know their economic and social policies are going to fail. They know it because they have.
Right? Well, they don't fail. The economic and social policies are going to fail to be sustainable because they provoke a response. The essence of their policy is looting. The essence of their policy is oppression. It's theft. It's suppression. And so sooner or later, the more successful that is, the stronger the reaction that's inevitable that comes from the people to it.
Yeah, and we're not even necessarily talking about a political or a reaction in electoral terms, because if you look at the history of Argentina, and the system just collapsed.
That's right.
Because the right-wing economic policies were so incredibly inept.
Yeah, they lost the legitimacy totally in front of the people.
So that's what's facing, for example, Brazil. It's what's facing Argentina. It's what's facing Ecuador. The interesting thing in Ecuador is an interesting question there is the voters in Ecuador are very sophisticated, like voters anywhere else, I suppose. Sophisticated, depending how you define sophistication, but that sophistication in terms of understanding their fundamental interests. And when I say that, a majority of the voters. So that's why Rafael Correa was so successful from 2006 until last year's election, which saw Lenin Moreno take power, and then Lenin Moreno cut a deal with the right wing. But Lenin Moreno's policies are essentially not going to, they're going to be a reversion to the policies that failed Ecuador sunk the country into crisis between 1998 and 2006, something like that.
Yeah.
And so if Lenin Moreno continues on that path, we should, in our next conversation, we should talk about the consultative referendum that's going to be held in Ecuador, because that's going to be crucial at a regional level, not just at a national level.
Well, we've got about 2 minutes. Want to do a 10-cent sketch of it so we can, maybe we can pick
yeah,
up
sure.
some detail
and,
next
and
week.
If we have that time available, then and the consultative referendum in Ecuador is a measure that's been an illegal measure because it's not been approved as it constitutionally should have been by the Supreme Court. But because the elites want it to happen, it was an idea of the opposition in the election campaign of 2017. It was the opposition that was calling for this referendum, and now Lenin Moreno has given it to them on a plate. And there's an economic component, there's an environmental component, but the fundamental political component is an attempt to entrench right-wing political possibilities in power, so that they have a better chance. The right wing will have a better chance as a result if this consultative referendum is approved of being able to hold on to political power, because there are two main things that the referendum is about. One is to prevent Rafael Correa from standing for election again.
Right.
And the other is to give the president power over what until now, as a result of the citizens' revolution that Rafael Correa facilitated, there's a popular council that is able to play a role in political decision making, an independent role. And what Lenin Moreno wants to do is to end that independence and bring and so as to be able to put his people on to nominate the composition of that commission. So and those are the two fundamental political things, and the economic and environmental things are also very important, but they're a bit more complicated.
Yeah.
And the essential thing there is that the referendum talks about tweaks to a few hundred square kilometers of an environmentally protected area. But essentially what they're doing is, because the drilling techniques are so sophisticated now, and what they're actually facilitating is a deeper exploitation of an area that until now has been environmentally protected.
Yeah, and this is like a whole basket of goodies. We're going to have to stop here and pick it up next week, but we will pick it up here. So thank you very much, Tony. Appreciate your time.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Let's talk about Ecuador next week if we can.
You got it. Yep. Okay, bye. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. We're told a secret society existed within the FBI with a sole intent to undermine candidate and then later President Donald Trump. Also, we're told the FBI lost text messages from members of this secret society. With Russiagate rapidly losing steam, do we now have FBI Gate? Crosstalking released the memo. I'm joined by my guest, Daniel Faraci in Washington. He is director of Grassroots Political Consulting. In Atlanta, we have Kevin Shipp. He is a former Central Intelligence Agency officer, as well as author of From the Company of Shadows. And in Lake Jackson, we cross to Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Kevin, you drove 3 hours to come to this program, so you have the honor of having the first question here. Okay. Kevin, you know, when I was growing up, I was a young boy, but I used to play hooky from school to watch the Watergate hearings. The only time I ever did that when I was a school kid, even a student. And it was quite fascinating. It's probably why I ended up what I'm doing now. And what was interesting then is that a crime was committed and then an investigation ensued. And the Nixon White House tried to recruit the FBI to do dirty tricks, fix things, to make the cover-up go away, et cetera, et cetera. Now we have this situation in Washington where it's the FBI that seems to be driving what's going on here. Russiagate has lost a lot of steam. We can still have the innuendos and the rumors and the leaks, but it hasn't amounted to anything. But day after day, it looks like the FBI is where the real problem is. Kevin, go ahead.
Yes, the real concern here is it appears that there's been a weaponization of the secret intelligence agencies, in this case specifically FBI counterintelligence. And the huge concern here is it appears that FBI management colluded and FBI agents actually swore false affidavits to the FISA court, to the right. FISA court judges, which resulted in NSA surveillance of a presidential campaign and transition team. That is very serious.
Okay, well, it's called the fruit of the poison tree. Daniel in Washington here. Is there a real crisis going on here? I mean, this is the premier law enforcement agency in the United States, certainly, maybe even in the whole world here. Are these people that can be trusted lost emails? Counterintelligence is supposed to be watching emails, and they lose their own? I mean, I'm sorry. It is hard for me to believe that. Go ahead, Daniel, in Washington.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a few answers to this question. One is the FBI in specific. Since Herbert Hoover and the movie that was portrayed on him up to Comey, the FBI has been a political institution. I know great agents that work there and some that have left there, but in the bureaucracy and the leadership, it has been known as a political weapon and has been utilized. Look at Bill Clinton's background as well. I mean, it's a lot of very recent history where it's continued to be used in the way it is. Yes, we do right now have a constitutional crisis where Devin Nunes, many of the other congressmen, House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Ron Johnson, in his statements yesterday, they have woken up to the fact of the flagrant abuse, weaponization, and politicization of this institution. And it creates a very dangerous precedent because this goes back to a Hoover-style in the way that they're doing things and being able to, as Kevin had just said, surveil a candidate and surveil a transition team under false pretenses, missing text messages. Come on. There's no such thing. I could recover my own if I deleted them tomorrow. This is just beyond the pale.
Daniel, in Lake Jackson, we have J. Edgar Comey, I think, is the new movie that's going to be made here. But what it's very troubling is that Peter Strzok, he's kind of their premier character in all of this right now. I mean, the Hillary emails, and then we have the Flynn interrogation, et cetera, et cetera. He still has his job. Why? Why? Why isn't he on leave? Why isn't he gone in front of implications of what he's done? I mean, there's none of it at all. We don't even hear from him. Go ahead.
Well, this goes back to the whole problem with the FBI in the first place. Remember when it was first formed, the first thing it did is started spying on anti-war people in the early part of the 20th century and putting them to jail. FBI agents do what, if the rest of us did it, we would be sent to jail. And that's the core problem. And blundering and losing, quote, losing evidence is nothing new. Look at the Clive and Bundy case in the western part of the United States. They absolutely obstructed justice. They got rid of evidence to exonerate them. And they were found to doing it. The same thing happened, if you remember, a few years ago in Ruby Ridge, in Waco under President Clinton. This is part and parcel of what the FBI does. This is the danger of having an organization like the FBI a national police force, a kind of a Stasi for the United States. So it really is nothing new, but what they do, the rest of us would be thrown in jail if we did it.
Yeah. Kevin, what is Jeff Sessions doing? I mean, is he perpetually on vacation? Or maybe, we don't know, maybe he has already called some special investigations. He's not obligated to tell the public that he's doing that. As a matter of fact, he really can't, okay? But I really have to wonder, I mean, you know, there is so many of these things, you know, we want to find out. There's Donald Trump in the White House. There's Jeff Sessions at the Department of Justice. They can release any documents they want. What's going on? Explain it. Kevin.
Well, you know, Peter, I was in counterintelligence with the CIA, and we worked daily with the FBI. And at the lower levels, I worked with some absolutely fantastic FBI agents. But at the upper levels, I can tell you, we saw a constant politicization by FBI supervisors, even leaking information to the press on cases that we had. But up to Attorney General Sessions, one thing we did learn about the FBI and was kind of frustrating, it'll take them a year or years to investigate a case, just moving, plodding along, dotting every I, crossing every T. I think Sessions is just being careful, slow, and really meticulous in what he's doing. It's frustrating. They're not going to come out and say things that will get Sessions or others in trouble until they have things solidified. So although it's kind of frustrating, and I hear all the time people are wondering about Sessions, but silence does not necessarily mean that there's a bad thing going on. It could just mean that Trump and Sessions are building a solid, irrefutable case.
Okay, well, Daniel, in Washington, do you think that case is against Jim Comey, Loretta Lynch, Samantha Power? I mean, in these types of people here, because it appears that they have their fingerprints all over this. And then we can talk about the entire history of the quote unquote Russia dossier, okay, which is a whole different avenue to go down. Go ahead, Daniel in Washington.
I think the problem, I kind of disagree on the Attorney General Sessions part.
Okay.
He has not been effective. He has not been a good leader. And he has not done, which is unprecedented, when you have a change of party, you get rid of all of the institutional employees and you bring in your own people. This has Obama-era attorneys working all throughout his institution. He brings Rod Rosenstein in and also, you know, recuses himself instead of proactively addressing the administration on this entire special counsel investigation. In addition to that, the White House is not known as a well-run machine right now. They do not have their act together internally. And this is, you can see it in State Department, DOD, so many other places that really need White House direction. But I find that Attorney General Sessions is not doing his job effectively. You mentioned a litany of things that he should be speaking about, at least addressing and hiring and directing, and he's just not doing it. And I think that was, you know, a poor choice to have him in that position. And if we had Rudy Giuliani right now, we'd have a completely opposite situation.
Absolutely.
In the Department of Justice.
Daniel, in Lake Jackson, I mean, you know, one of the things that we're witnessing right now, and I think is the real dilemma, is that you have this you have many people in the highest echelons of the FBI that appear to be in collusion. From what we know, let's be careful here. And then you have the special prosecutor, and juxtapose both of them here. I mean, if Mueller comes out with something, you know, and it's accusatory, inflammatory, there's going to be a lot of people, and I'm going to be one of them, going to say, but what about investigating the investigators? Do you see the kind of deadlock this is going to create? And I think that's another real crisis that the country is facing. There's no confidence in the probe. I mean, of course, you wouldn't hear that on CNN and MSNBC. I mean, the junk that they spew is just extraordinary. But the rest of the country is listening and wondering what's going on. Is there a crisis here? Go ahead, Daniel, in Lake Jackson.
Well, I wonder how many of the rest of us, and I'm sure, Peter, you feel the same way, are wondering about the Mueller investigation. Where's Russia? This whole thing was talking. We should remember this is all about. This is all about whether President Trump and his campaign team.
Please forgive me. I forgot all about that. Okay, you're right. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. You're supposed to. Just relax. You'll be okay. Listen to CNN. No, we're not talking. This was a very, very limited investigation of whether the Trump campaign and Trump himself colluded with Russia, whether 5 or 6 years ago, President Putin woke up one morning and said, you know what, I bet Donald Trump is going to be president someday. So let's set up this whole chain of events to entrap him in a way that we can manipulate him and make him our puppet. This is what the whole thing was supposed to be about.
Yep.
And now we're talking about an interview with Trump and Mueller to talk about whether there might have been obstruction of justice when he fired Comey. As a previous speaker said very well, he had a right to fire all these people, and he should have. That was probably his big mistake. He's all bluster and no action.
Okay, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Release the Memo.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, Kevin, let me go back to you in Atlanta. I guess we have another dilemma facing us here. Again, you know, there's a viewer of CNN or MSNBC, if they accidentally tuned into this program here, they wouldn't have a clue of what we're talking about, okay? And I'm talking about Release the Memo. And of course, you know, I'm really glad that Twitter and Facebook corrected the record. You know, it's not, actually, we're using the hashtag for this program right now. But after Facebook and Twitter said it wasn't Russian bots. Okay, so we're in the clear here at Crosstalk. But Kevin here, this memo either is going to, it's going to unglue everything, or it's the all-time nothing burger. Because depending on what media outlet you're watching, you have a choice. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, yeah, this memo could and probably will unravel the Russian collusion narrative. Right now, the memo's classified secret, and unfortunately, the government overuses that to conceal information from Congress. But I think the pressure from the public is so strong that this memo will be released. Congressmen and senators who've seen it have come out and said that it is a shocking abuse of power by the FBI and the CIA, for that matter, who leaked the dossier information, calling it intelligence. The memo is serious. It very possibly documents illegal criminal activity on the part of some FBI agents. We don't know whether it's Strzok or who, that falsified affidavits to the FISA court. And you don't lie to a judge. That's serious. This memo is going to come out. I'm absolutely convinced. It's going to stop the entire Russian narrative, and it's going to turn things back on what I hope will be a criminal probe into abuse of power in the uppermost levels of the FBI.
Daniel, in Washington, would that prompt what, I'm going to again betray my age here, like a church commission? Or is it so polarized now that it would be impossible? Gentlemen, I'm very serious here. Even if evidence comes out, there was incriminating evidence for the FBI, these people are very, very powerful, and they have the resource called the media behind them. So this is the collision I'm worried about. What people speculate that are in that memo, I've been saying on this program for 18 months, so I'm not surprised, okay? Go ahead, Daniel in Washington.
Two quick points. Kevin, I agree with that it will come out, and the insurmountable pressure will come, and there probably will be some heads that will roll because of it. But as I've said on this program many times before, from Syria to Ukraine to sanctions to expansion of NATO, to continued provocation of Russia phobia from here to the EU to UK, to blame Russia for everything from Brexit to our election. The narrative will never cease against Russia and Russian collusion, because we still seek to take advantage from Russia over Arctic mineral natural resources. And that's what the crux of all this has been since 2011. So unfortunately, even though this could be a huge smoking gun, that narrative will not cease, and they're provocating and spreading that continuously. You hear it every day in the halls of Congress to throughout this town. So that's not going to change. I wish it would, but it just simply won't.
Well, Daniel, in Lake Jackson, that's a very interesting point. I believe this anti-Russia hysteria will continue irrespective, okay? It's not based on anything. It's just a hysterical supposition that has been inserted into public discourse here. But, I mean, it will, and this kind of goes into my mantra about the media. I mean, when we read the memo, we all will. It's only 4 pages, and we'll all read it very fast, and we'll, depending on how you look at everything, you're going to come to conclusions very quickly. I'm pretty sure about that. But, you know, do you think, and this is what's really got me, got my goat for the last year, how is the mainstream media going to spin this? I mean, are they actually going to say that, the Republicans in Congress are now, drum roll, everybody, oh, they're in cahoots with the Russians, because that's what they're going to say. All of the GOP in the House is working for Vladimir Putin. It's not impossible, Daniel. Go ahead, and Lake Jackson.
And I agree with you on that, but I tend to slightly disagree a bit with the other guests on the memo itself. I believe it might be a bit of political theater.
Sure.
You know, this was authored by Devin Nunes and particularly his staff on the House Intelligence Committee. And Nunes is known for overselling things. He's done it in the past. Here's Nunes who had this information in his hands. He knew about the FBI's abuse of the FISA process, yet he was one of the key members of the House of Representatives demanding that we extend Section 702 of the FISA court so they can continue spying on the rest of us.
Yeah.
So his credentials on actually caring about the abuse of the FISA system are very, very suspect. The other aspect of the memo, the Republicans screaming, release the memo, release the memo, do a Mike Gravel. Mike Gravel went to the floor of the Senate and he read the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record. That's how we found out what was going in Vietnam. So all the members that are whining and moaning about we need to release it, just get your butt down to the floor and read the memo and we'll finally hear it.
That's a great idea. Kevin, weigh in on because because the way it's polarized, even if I can use this word, because it's so abused these days, even if you get to the truth, will the truth be conveyed? Because, again, you have these major liberal networks and news outlets. They are so enamored with their own nonsense and their own vision because of their blind hatred of Donald Trump. And Russia is always a good foil. It has the Cold War all the way to the present. Okay, what I'm saying is, they don't have to have any kind of anything that touches reality because the narrative has such a strong current that facts don't matter. And I worry about that, too. Go ahead, Kevin in Atlanta.
Yeah, I agree. This is the people's house, the Congress and the Senate. They need to take this memo down to the floor. I couldn't agree more and read it to the American people. Yeah, constitutionally, that's who they serve. And with the mainstream media, I think we all have to understand the mainstream media in terms of reporting the truth is essentially gone. Mm-hmm. There are 6 major corporations that control the media. About 20 CEOs control the news and the editors. They're connected into Wall Street, what some are calling the deep state now. And also, I am aware of the fact for some years that even the CIA has connections and control to the media in kind of a quid pro quo relationship. And sometimes the media will just parrot what the government says. So the media is gone. There's no question about that.
Daniel, should we believe the FBI anymore? I mean, this is a crisis, a huge crisis that they're dealing with. And is it possible to clean up the FBI? I mean, mass firing? I mean, it'll be the Saturday Night Massacre or 1937, Soviet Union. I mean, it would have to be a huge purge.
Yeah, it is possible to do, and it starts with the director. Why Christopher Wray was ever inserted in there from this administration, I have no idea.
What is he up to?
They need somebody that... they need a non-attorney that was actually served in the intelligence services, has a background, is not tied to the bureaucracy, and could go up and clean up and bring in whoever they want. That would be the way to do it. And it will remain an institution, so you have to clean it up, or they're just going to let it run amok, as it has been for so many years. And then as far as graduating to the special counsel, we know, in spite of this memo, whether it's released or not, The only thing they're going to charge is either trying to trip up the president on a perjury charge his interview, or simply money laundering and financial impropriety from people like Manafort and Flynn. And if I were the president and advising him right now to kill the collusion story once and for all, I would just advise him to say, hey, look at my campaign team. At the end of the day, if they were handed a blueprint from the Russian government, these guys are so incompetent, they couldn't have done it on their best day. And then you kill the rest of that story. That's what I would do.
That's absolutely perfect. I love that. Daniel, weigh in on that, because I think that's absolutely brilliant here. It's taken on a life of its own, this own Russiagate thing. I mean, you can find anything around the world. Oh, did you hear that Russia now has these killer crocodiles, and it's all, pointed against America and the West? No, that's a real story. That's a real story that popped up here. Where is this, Daniel, where is this going to go? Where is this going to go with the FBI?
Well, I guess I'm a little radical because I don't believe we need an FBI.
I agree.
We survive for 100 and some years without one. There's no use of having it. The intelligence services can handle counterintelligence just fine. Most of the crimes that the FBI is involved in are made-up crimes. Most of the terrorism that it investigates, it itself has been involved in fomenting. So we don't need an FBI. Just to the issue of the news, I would mention one other thing, and I'm sure you know this, Peter. Hamilton 68, the organization, the Association for Defending Democracy, Bill Kristol, Mike Morrell.
Yeah, yeah.
This is an organization funded by the U.S. government.
Yeah.
And this is the one that is following all of our hashtags and all our Twitter accounts, and it finds Russia bots everywhere. So you have collusion among the neocons and the never Trump Hillaryites. That's a perfect storm. That's what's keeping this alive.
Yeah. Kevin, Hamilton 68, I'm sure, is a big fan of this program. I'm waiting for their next scribe to write about us. Okay. Kevin, I mean, you've been in government here. I mean, what is the possibility of correcting these wrongs? And these are wrongs that we only know now. It seems so much more could come out. Go ahead.
Well, I'm really concerned that Russian crocodile is going to get Donald Trump. No, I'm just kidding. In terms of the FBI, we know that over and over and over, Michael Flynn's a good example. If the FBI can't prove a charge like Russia collusion, they'll drum up something else. Their favorites are lying to investigators. In the case of Trump, what Mueller is starting to do is veer off of Russia into obstruction of justice and try to get Trump on an unrelated charge. That's what they do. They say they always get their man, and they mean that, even if it's an injustice to do that. That's a concern. Will people be prosecuted? It's going to be almost virtually impossible to prosecute anyway. That's the way what some people call the deep state shadow government works. It protects its own from the top down. But I'm telling you, people, and this is where the American people come in to demand this through their congressmen and senators. They need to demand that people, if there were false sworn affidavits for FISA warrants on a presidential campaign, the American people need to demand not just firings or reassignments, but criminal prosecution.
Right.
Who watches the watchman? Who investigates
right.
the FBI? We've got an out-of-control, weaponized FBI now. Something dramatically needs to be done about that. And the American people need to scream and cry and demand that.
We've run out of time, gentlemen. I have a feeling that Donald Trump will be indicted for over Twitter use? I don't know. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, Atlanta, and in Lake Jackson. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.